I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Bohemia is no longer a small and embattled refuge for society's weirdos and starving artists. According to Vanderbilt professor Richard Lloyd, it is now an established district in every medium-sized city, driving up real estate prices. He calls it neo-bohemia, and we'll find out how cities are promoting it as a lifestyle amenity today on Smart City. We'll also talk with Rich Bendis, who, as head of Innovation Philadelphia, is working to turn Philadelphia's creative economy into an international development asset for the city. We'll be back with Smart City guest Richard Lloyd and Rich Bendis right after the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Vanderbilt professor Richard Lloyd has discovered a new version of bohemia in Chicago's Wicker Park, and he reports his finding in his book, Neo-Bohemia, Art and Commerce in the Post-Industrial City. Richard, what is neo-bohemia?
Neo-bohemia, it's a concept that I kind of put together as a result of several years of research that I did on a neighborhood in Chicago, which had gone from being sort of an obscure and depopulated barrio ravaged by the effects of deindustrialization on Chicago's west side to suddenly become this hip center of urban culture and a teeming artist community. And I realized looking at it that, you know, we recognize these neighborhoods in part because they're part of very long traditions, that we have an idea about what living like an artist in the city is supposed to look like because it's been developed over many years, going back to 19th century Paris, the Paris of Balzac and Baudelaire. But I also felt like there's something new going on. And so on the one hand, there's quite a bit of continuity, and I can talk about some of the ways that that shows up in Wicker Park, how it's recognizable as continuous with Montmartre or the Latin Quarter, or Greenwich Village, or, you know, Venice Beach, or all these other sort of enclaves that have preceded it. But there's something about cities and the nature of our society and our economy in the late 20th century, heading into the 21st century, that are different and that make certain aspects of the artist's experience in the city qualitatively different and very interesting. So I use the idea of neo-bohemia to sort of get at that combination of continuity and also change that was happening there.
I have a question for you before we talk about both the continuities and discontinuities, the way in which it's alike and the way in which it's not like bohemia in history. But is your concept of bohemia necessarily a place? Can it be instead a collection of people who come together for special occasions and then disperse?
Well, actually, it's interesting because this is an issue that I deal with it at some great amount of length in the book. There's a common recurring refrain in bohemias, which I do to give away the answer, I do think of as importantly being places, that bohemia is not a place, but a state of mind. And so you'll hear this in various stages. People say, well, it's really, you know, you can't really understand this by its geography. You have to understand it as a sort of cultural ethos that can be disconnected from space. And I actually don't see it that way. I find it much more conceptually useful to think of it as both a place and a state of mind, and to think of the way that that state of mind is conditioned by the experience of being in the place, and how the place is shaped by this sort of collective state of mind of at least some of the people who are occupying it. So I really think of the place dimension as very important, and I think that there are good conceptual reasons for doing that and also very good historical reasons for doing that too. Because it turns out that, you know, Greenwich Village and Bloomsbury and North Beach and the East Village and Wicker Park in Chicago where I did my work, these places really, really matter as being platforms to make visible and to support, you know, this state of mind.
Richard, you said that ideas of bohemia are deeply rooted and that in some ways living like an artist in the city today is similar to those deeply rooted ideas. And yet you say there are differences in the post-industrial city. Tell me about those two sides of things.
Well, I think, you know, there are certain things. I mean, the idea of the starving artist and the romance of the starving artist, so art for art's sake, that this is a higher calling for which one is supposed to make inordinate levels of sacrifice. And one of the things you'll find in these neighborhoods is a lot of people who buy into that theory and support you in that theory. So maybe your parents don't support your decision to spend your post-collegiate years waiting tables and living in a hovel and doing drugs and that sort of thing. But there are other people around you that are going to support that. And it is a sort of a socially acceptable story one can tell about oneself, right? That you're a bohemian who is poor by choice, which is far less déclassé. There's also a fascination with the illicit, the world of the underworld, with extravagant experiences, whether it's sexual experimentation, experimentation with drugs and alcohol, these sorts of things we see recurring over and over again. I certainly saw in Chicago. So a resistance to the idea of the staid, secure world of the bourgeoisie, or now of the yuppie, you know, careerist. Some of the things that are different, though, have to do with the changing economy of the cities in which these spaces are embedded, so that there's a much bigger audience, in a sense, for Bohemia as we shift away from the modal workforce in Chicago being blue-collar manufacturing laborers towards them being, you know, white-collar professionals. There are many more people who clamor for participation, who look to take their cues from Bohemian artists. Another thing that's changed is just the size of the cultural economy in the United States and throughout the globe has grown much larger. So, you know, with the tremendous explosion, things like popular music, film, television, the book industry, new media like the internet, and also economic activities with extreme aesthetic dimensions like advertising and marketing, this creates a greater and greater demand for creative labor. We've seen the number of artists grow concomitant with that demand. So from about 300,000 as measured by the census in 1960 to about 2.5 million today. So these are pretty extravagant increases as well. So it just comes to play quite a bit larger role in new urban economies as a result of these transformations, as a spur for gentrification, but also as an organizing principle for certain kinds of economic activity. It's especially interesting in a city like Chicago, where its old industrial economy is essentially withered away. So in Chicago, as I'm fond of saying, if it used to be steel and stockyards, now it's culture and technology. And this has dramatically elevated the role of new bohemias in the post-industrial city.
It's interesting to me that these neighborhoods have become marketing tools for cities. They have gained a level, these neighborhoods and the people in them have gained a new level of sophistication about marketing their neighborhood, marketing their work. And then cities add a layer onto that because they see it as a way to generate quality of life, amenities, tourism, commerce. Is that a new phenomenon?
Well, I think you make a really good point. And it's interesting. Certain cities have been particularly effective at doing this, and they're mid-sized cities like Seattle and Portland and Austin, Texas, so that, you know, it's in Portland, keep Portland weird or keep Austin weird, become not just, you know, the hopes of fringe artists, but the official slogans of public sector boosters. So I do think that's new, and it runs against, I think, the initial thoughts coming out of the urban crises of the 1970s about what it would take to produce urban renewal, which was to eradicate all the sort of grit to scrub up the city, to Disneyfy it, which is what a lot of people saw as the new direction of urbanism, that everything was going to become like Chicago's Navy Pier or the redeveloped Disneyfied Times Square in New York City, or the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, that sort of thing, where they were essentially like these suburban shopping malls, you know, imposed upon the space of the city, and all the sort of funky, diverse, and occasionally somewhat tawdry aspects of the city would be wiped away. And what we find now with the embrace of the sort of new bohemian paradigm is that those things, those quirkier aspects of urban life and even some of the grittier aspects of urban life now get folded into a surprisingly marketable idea of urban authenticity.
How do those neighborhoods get started? How do neo-bohemia neighborhoods get started?
Well, one of the things that I found is that simply artists moving into the neighborhood isn't enough. So one of the interesting things in Wicker Park, it had a lot of advantages in Chicago. It was very well located on public transportation, and it had a decaying built environment, but a built environment that was very promising for this kind of gentrification. So there were a lot of low-rise factory, sort of older sweatshop structures or warehouses that were very easily convertible into lofts and gallery spaces, you know, nightclubs, restaurants, when that eventually happened. And a lot, and they had a cultural tradition there. The writer Nelson Algren had lived and written there in the 1940s and 50s, for example. And a lot of artists were moving in the 1980s. But it didn't gain the sort of the density and the visibility that it would gain in the 90s until some venues began to either transform themselves. If they had been, for instance, one, the first place I ever went to the neighborhood had been a Polish working class bar where they would, grizzled men would sort of sit in the early evening and drink shots and beer. And still were doing this, by the way, you know, well into the 90s. And then at night, you know, there would be folk music, Polish folk music, accordion music. In the 1980s, it switched over from polka to punk, which would clear the old men out, but you would get this new crowd of young scenesters coming in. You needed to find spaces where people could come together, where they could find each other. So one of my informants says, when I moved in the neighborhood in the 80s, everyone said there were a lot of artists, but there were no artists. I couldn't see them. Right, so you needed things like the opening of this big coffee shop, Urbis Orbis, that allowed people to find each other in these spaces, and that also, very importantly, allowed them to be found by outsiders. So suddenly, you know, you get all of these collaborations. Walking in the door of Urbis Orbis and seeing the artwork on the wall, the French art dealer Jim Happy Delpech got the idea of starting up a neighborhood arts festival. And suddenly, by 1994, Wicker Park is being identified by Rolling Stone as the hippest place to suck down a cappuccino in Chicago. The importance of small-scale entrepreneurs and semi-public venues like bars, restaurants, and coffee shops, particularly bars and coffee shops, because those are the drugs of choice very often for young artists to sort of stoke their creative impulses. Those things play a real role in creating a neighborhood identity, and that was important in Wicker Park, and a number of places were implicated in that in the late 1980s heading into the early 90s.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Richard Lloyd. He is author of Neo-Bohemia, Art and Commerce in the Post-Industrial City. It's interesting that you say Wicker Park didn't really take off until there were, in essence, commercial spaces, businesses, where artists could find each other and that people, outsiders, could find them, introducing the central role, as you identify it, of commerce in Neo-Bohemia. Now, who would have thought that? Do you find that incongruous?
I'm not sure exactly what you
mean.
Well,
do you find that the need for commerce, the need for business, the need for profit endeavors that, as you say, become sort of the linchpin for this new bohemian neighborhood to take off, in some ways runs counter to the idea of bohemia, starving artist, as an example?
I think, you know, certainly there's an idea that the artist is anti-capitalist, or at least anti-utilitarian. Baudelaire famously said, it's always seemed to me that to be a useful man would be a most hideous thing. On the other hand, I think going way back to Le Chat Noir or the Mud Club in the 1980s, I mean, spaces where people could find one another, and very often taverns or coffee shops where people could go and linger over many hours in discussion, conversation, these have long been very important. One of the things I think is important is a lot of the entrepreneurs that I talk to, and it's consistent with things that they did, so it doesn't seem to me to be disingenuous sort of evasion. A lot of the entrepreneurs that I talked to were themselves very interested not just in making money and having a successful business, that, but also in, you know, producing a scene. So they'd say, well, I wanted to make the kind of place that I wanted to go to be. You know, and so they located in these neighborhoods where artists were because artists were their friends, and they wanted to create the kind of place where they and their friends could hang out. And occasionally these businesses would do a lot of work towards making the scene and not do very much work towards making money. So Urbis Orbis, the coffee shop that was named in Rolling Stone and consistently considered to be one of the most popular and hippest places in the city of Chicago, lasted only a very small number of years before it eventually went out of business because, you know, it turns out that artists sitting around a table having endless conversations over a single refilled cup of coffee is not a very good way for the owner of the establishment to pay his rent.
But once the independent business people with their small shops, with their restaurants, do begin to experience success, then corporate America is likely to find these new bohemian neighborhoods and move in. Isn't that the case?
Well, I'm not sure what exactly you mean by corporate America, if you mean like Barnes & Noble or whatever.
And there are Starbucks and so forth. The brand names.
Starbucks did – I mean, it was interesting that Starbucks – I mean, certainly people viewed it when Starbucks finally opened up as apocalyptic as far as the integrity of the scene. I mean, there's no question about that. And it was long dreaded. I was interested how long it took for a Starbucks to open up. One of the owners of a local building that had many storefront businesses and artist lofts above those – refused, at least he insists to me that he refused Starbucks' application for a storefront in his building because he simply felt that that didn't go with the ambiance of the neighborhood that he was participating in as an entrepreneur. So it was interesting that it finally did open up in 2000, which was 6 years after a Starbucks opened up in the Forbidden City in Beijing. So I was interested that Wicker Park is a hot neighborhood, nonetheless, managed to hold Starbucks off as long as it did. One thing I would note is that as this stuff comes in, I mean, starving artists actually don't starve. And not all of them are trust fund babies either. So, you know, they have to find a way to support themselves as they're making their art. And one of the ways we know that artists, you know, will do this is to go to work in the service industry. So they will be not just, you know, frequenting bars as patrons, but they will be bartending or waiting tables or working in boutiques and that sort of thing. And they bring special skills and competences to that because they're hip, they're cool, they have mastery of nocturnal comportment, they dress in very good ways, they know lots of other cool people who come because they're there and they want to be where their friends are. And as the neighborhood gets more and more investment, and maybe not necessarily corporate America moving in, but certainly more profit-minded small entrepreneurs coming in. On the one hand, maybe it hurts their sense of ownership of the scene. On the other hand, it gives them a lot more opportunity to go out and get jobs. So like a lot of things that happen in these neighborhoods, it's a mixed bag. As the neighborhood becomes better known, more commodified, your audiences get bigger, your job opportunities get better. But maybe on the other hand, the scene isn't the scene that you thought you wanted in some other important ways.
Richard, we're going to have another conversation to discuss the real meaning of the mastery of nocturnal comportment. That is a great term, which we'll have to explore at another time. But from the point of view of City Hall, is neo-bohemia something to be encouraged or discouraged?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and maybe I would take a quick step back because another issue you asked about corporate America, and I think it does bear on urban policy, is there are ways that corporate America can benefit proximately, that is to say by opening up, you know, Barnes & Noble or Starbucks on the corner where the independent coffee shop or the old used bookstore used to be. And frankly, you know, the independent coffee shops and old used bookstores are still kind of there in Wicker Park, although they now have to slug it out with Starbucks. But there are other industries. I mean, big industries in film, television, popular music, industries like Nike that went into Wicker Park and found one of its small graphic design internet firms that was stocked with kids who were heavy participants in the neighborhood culture and used them as subcontractors to create sort of funky, youth-oriented, hip advertising. Or who, you know, come in and pluck from among the legions of as yet undiscovered bands that are thundering nightly in local venues, such as the one that made the crossover from polka to punk. Where I saw, the first time I went, I saw Veruca Salt, who within a year was signed by Geffen Records. And those big enterprises that are not in the neighborhood benefit tremendously from activities that happen in the neighborhood. Right, they benefit a lot from the kid who's working three jobs and living in an apartment with six other guys in order to support his attempts to become a successful musician for maybe a number of years before such a time as a major record label says, okay, now we would like to give you a try. That's a lot of research and development that goes on in a neighborhood like Wicker Park that they don't have to pay for. Right, until such a time as they deem that a desirable risk to take. So in other words, to think about the neighborhood, and one of the key contributions that I hope my book makes is to really highlight the way that if we're going to think about what's happening at the neighborhood, we can't stay only at the neighborhood level. Right? We have to think about the way this is networked into all of these other processes that are unfolding in the larger city economy, in the national economy, and in fact in a global economy.
Can cities deliberately pursue the creation of a new bohemian neighborhood, or, Richard, would that just kill it?
The question of organic process versus, you know, something that's kind of imposed from above, I think there are real limits to what sorts of things the city can do to impose this sort of thing. And then the questions would be, you know, if there's a catalyst for these things, I mean, what sorts of things can a city do to nurture it along, or is it supposed to just stay out of the way? I mean, maybe one thing I would suggest is greater attention to encouraging small businesses in these sorts of neighborhoods of the sort that I described. Independent bookstores, record stores, boutiques, coffee shops, restaurants, taverns, that sort of thing, that I think are very important. So, you know, to the extent that cities can work to encourage the flourishing of these things, I've heard lots of other sorts of plans. You know, do we subsidize, you know, housing for artists? And then, of course, I might have some difficulty with that, only in the sense of, first, how do you identify who gets to count as an artist and who does not? And second, you know, how do you really make a case that artists are more deserving of the limited resources of the state than so many other deprived groups that are also occupying cities today?
Interesting questions. We'll have to have time to explore them further. Richard, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Richard Lloyd is author of Neo-Bohemia, Art and Culture in the Post-Industrial City. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Rich Bendis about the creative economy in Philadelphia, and we'll talk to Otis White about news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, as city economies rely increasingly on universities and hospitals, tension is developing over their tax-exempt status. Explain what's happening.
There is a big shift that's been going on for decades in cities, and it's starting to catch up with the city governments. If you went back 40 years ago and you looked at employment in most downtowns, you'd see that it was very largely around private corporations, headquarters, banks, those sorts of things, a lot of retail. Increasingly, the inner city's employment base is that of nonprofit colleges and universities, and they have grown enormously in this period of time, research and in all kinds of ways, and then traditional nonprofits, the United Way and so on. So cities are constantly running up against, we're offering services to institutions that in a lot of cases are exempt from paying the primary local tax, which is the property tax. So they're scratching their heads trying to figure out what can they do to provide services at a reasonable cost to a tax base that is rapidly shifting. In St. Paul, Minnesota, a city council member has suggested that they begin to tack on activities fees for the students who come there, and there are 11 colleges in St. Paul, the most famous of which is McAllister College. The students make up 13% of the city's population. There are 37,000 students who live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and so he's proposing that they simply do, you know, the thing that you and I paid when we were in college, the student activities fee, they tack on a city's activities fee, and of $25 a year for the students, which would bring in about $1 million to St. Paul. And not surprisingly, the universities are not pleased with this idea. I know you'll be shocked to hear that, but they think this is really a bad, bad idea. They think it will simply hurt the local economy. And the city council member says, look, he's just trying to find some way of financing the services that are given to students who otherwise don't pay many of the taxes that the locals do.
That's a tax that could be levied at the local level?
Well, we'll find out if it gets passed in St. Paul. But yes, apparently they can do it. Some cities have been asking nonprofits to actually give voluntarily to the city, colleges and universities and other nonprofits, and they've done that. So that might be one approach, is to ask the colleges to tack on this fee and on a voluntary basis.
It's an interesting debate. It's one going on all over the country. And you wonder if they manage to tax colleges and universities, which nonprofits will be next?
Yes,
there are private schools. There are, of course, hospitals. And so this is a real tension point in cities.
It is. And don't forget, there are churches there, too. And they are, in many cases, large landowners in cities. So who knows where all this could go?
We'll watch this one. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, Otis. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rich Bendis is president and CEO of Innovation Philadelphia, a public-private partnership dedicated to increasing the region's entrepreneurial capacity and positioning Philadelphia as a leader in the global knowledge economy. Rich has been an entrepreneur, a corporate executive, venture capitalist, investment banker, and consultant in the technology and healthcare industries. He previously headed the Kansas Technology Enterprise Corporation. Rich, tell me about the work of Innovation Philadelphia.
Carol, Innovation Philadelphia is a four-year-old private-public partnership that covers 11 counties in southeastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, and northern Delaware. We have a mission to enhance the global innovation economy of the region. We do that by doing direct investments. We manage some investment programs and early stage funds and angel funds. We assist in the commercialization of technologies, whether they be at academic institutions, entrepreneurs, or trying to extract intellectual property from large corporations and building companies around them. And we have a workforce development component, which is built around internships and trying to connect students to employers as early in their academic careers as possible so that we can do more in retaining the bright knowledge workers of tomorrow. And we think that also what we're seeing emerging, which really talks about the diversity of our programs, is there is a convergence between technology-based economic development and workforce development. And that's going to be critical for those economies that are going to be most innovative in the future of this global economy.
I want to focus on this notion of innovation. Tell me, Rich, I know you have been a venture capitalist, you've run new enterprises, you've been an investment banker. What is it that is fundamental to a business's ability to innovate?
Basically, being able to see something that other people can't and that the market is going to be willing to pay for. And I think some of the greatest inventions and innovations we have in the world have happened serendipitously or by accident. But today, I think that, you know, innovation is really not, there's not a formal process for innovation. Sometimes it just happens. Other times, you can somewhat plan your innovations like large corporations do when they're looking at new generations of products and technology. I believe that what our job in this region is with innovation is to focus on these low-hanging fruit, emerging opportunities, find the serial entrepreneurs or those individuals who are bright, knowledgeable, but might not have all of the resources necessary to build a business themselves. And then we think our goal is to connect the resources so that we can accelerate the rate of innovation within this region.
When you think about what is internal to a business in terms of its ability to innovate, and you try to think then beyond the confines of a business and you think about the community, which is your territory, what are the elements that have to be in place to increase a community's ability to innovate? You talked about one of them, and that is the ability to identify good people and encourage them, support them, invest in them, and make sure they're connected to resources. What else is important?
You have to create an environment that is an innovation environment. And we've been blessed here in Philadelphia because this is really the birthplace of innovation. And we're going to celebrate January 17th, Ben Franklin's 300th anniversary. So there has been a significant history here. That's one thing that you can't really build in communities where there isn't a history of that. You can actually build for the future, but now we've had a historical perspective. So that's an important ingredient which we've been blessed with to have in Philadelphia. The other thing is, I think it's extremely important to have mentors or examples of innovators who remain committed to the community in which they've become successful. And just as we've seen with Bill Gates and what's happened with Seattle, or you look at Steve Jobs and some of the other more successful innovators in the world, they have not left the community in which they've innovated. And I think that's extremely important. For example, with us in the creative economy, the Roberts family with the founding of Comcast, the largest broadband provider in the United States today, they are committed to the Philadelphia region. So having very visible, global, successful innovators who also remained engaged and committed in their communities is another criteria for trying to build an innovation economy.
You've introduced this term, creative economy. Tell me what you really mean by that. That term is thrown around a lot. Is there one definition that we can all agree on and we know what we're talking about?
We have tried to standardize a definition that we are working towards in the Philadelphia region, and it's based on ideas that are generated by human capital, and the members of this creative economy have a high level of skill in the cultural, fine, or applied arts, and they also create, teach, and generate technical innovation, drive, design, and cultivate change. So it's very broad-based because we want to be inclusive with the definition. And we also think that sometimes people are too limiting with the parameters they place around the definition of the creative economy. So we tend to be a little more liberal than those who are more defined.
In other words, you're focusing on more than the arts. Is that a fair way to put it? Or what's the distinction you're making in terms of you're broadening from what to what?
Basically, a lot of people just focus on the arts only, and we think engineers, architects, designers, graphic designers, software engineers are also very creative and knowledgeable individuals, and if you look at the convergence of technology and innovation today, it's very hard to come up with a clear-cut definition because things are converging on each other. And it's very difficult to separate the people who are even in performing arts and the technology that they used within their performances that otherwise didn't exist 10 years ago. So I think that we think that it's important to show how there is an interaction with technology in the creative economy rather than trying to silo the creative economy.
And you're trying to tackle this at a global level by bringing together something you call the Global Creative Economy Summit this summer in Philadelphia for business and technology leaders, entrepreneurs, arts and cultural leaders. You are inviting all of them worldwide to converge in Philadelphia. And what do you hope to accomplish in that summit?
Well, I think that the summit's going to have multiple goals. Number one, the leaders within the world in this emerging global creative economy have yet to be defined. There are some areas that have a little lead. You know, Toronto's looked upon as a very creative, innovative city. There are some areas within Japan. You have Karlsruhe over in Germany. And other areas that, even though they may have distinguished themselves in that way, I'd say that the playing field is wide open for creative and progressive regions to put a mark on themselves and brand themselves. Because we think this is an extremely important economic component of the Philadelphia region. So one of the first things we want to accomplish is to showcase Philadelphia. If you remember, you had a chance to come here in, I think it was December of 2004, to be at a creative economy conference that we had where you spoke. And I think a lot of the people who came in from outside of the Philadelphia region were amazed by the resources that we have in Philadelphia within the creative economy. Second of all, what we want to do is create this virtual platform for the creative and knowledgeable people around the world to interact with one another. And we think that by bringing people together for a three-day summit around the creative economy, we can get people to interact that otherwise hadn't and to develop long-lasting relationships. And I think when you look at this broad definition that we have defined, I think we can open some people's eyes and broaden their perspectives on what the creative economy really is. And I guess lastly, we think that a lot of people focus on the creative class but haven't focused on the economic impact of it. That's why we are calling this a Creative Economy Convergence Summit. We would like to see the convergence of technology, arts, business come together, but at the end of the day, we're an economic development organization. If we can't see some enhancement in the economy, then we won't be as engaged or as interested in the creative class unless we can see how we can grow the economy of the Greater Philadelphia region around that. So those would be four things we would hope to accomplish through this.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Rich Bendis. He's president and CEO of Innovation Philadelphia, which this summer will host the Global Creative Economy Convergence Summit. Rich, tell me who exemplifies this economic energy that you're trying to capture. I'm sure that you've selected your primary speakers for the meeting. Tell me who looks like the role models that you want to lift up.
Well, as you know, anytime you're going to have a global summit, there's a lot of competition for attendees. So you really would like to have people that you find that the attendees would have an interest in listening to or participating with. And we have a couple early commitments from some nationally or internationally recognized people that will be coming to the summit. First are artists Christo and Jean-Claude. And Christo and Jean-Claude, they've been together for almost 40 years now. They live in New York City. And the last work that they did was The Gates. And if you remember, that's out in Central Park in New York, where they basically draped New York City with the fabric and materials, and they actually didn't have any external capital to pay for this. They funded this project totally themselves. And if you look at economic impact around the creative economy and what they did, the city of New York believes that over $250 million in tourism and other spending for the city occurred as a result of this public-private partnership that they had in Central Park. So they've been doing this for 40 years. They've had some very interesting projects. And there is a convergence of technology and craftsmen in every one of the projects that they take on. So we think that they're going to be very interesting to speak with. And, Carol, you'll find it very interesting. People of that international acclaim you would think would be hard to get to, but we picked up the phone, called them. They answered the phone themselves. They do all the negotiations themselves. They didn't want a plane. They just want to have a car drive them down. They want to drive back the same day. And it's really refreshing to deal with people like this who could dictate and demand whatever they would like. And we think that the audience is going to be very interested in interacting with them. A second person that we've been able to attract is Daniel Pink, who's the author of the best-selling book, A Whole New Mind. And we all know Richard Florida's work in The Creative Class, which was done a couple years ago, and Richard's got a new book out now. But Daniel Pink has taken a different perspective around The Creative Class, looking at how this group is really going to be a different kind of worker, the next business elite, as he refers to them. And they really have a different kind of mind in which we have to respond to. They're the artists, inventors, and the people who are going to power the future corporations and organizations of tomorrow. So I think it's a different perspective than what we've heard people traditionally talk about around The Creative Class. So for a beginning, Christo and Jean-Claude and Daniel Pink have already signed up to be two of our keynote speakers in June.
Dan has been a guest on our show a couple of times with both of his books, and I'm a huge fan of Dan's and had a chance to hear him for the first time out at a meeting we both were on the program of in Silicon Valley, and he is a terrific speaker. So Dan alone is worth the price of admission. He's terrific. And then to add Christo and Jean-Claude is pretty exciting. Rich, what new understanding, new knowledge do you expect to result from the summit?
Well, basically, if you look at some of the things that we want to focus on in the summit, there's going to be some very elementary and sort of intro to the creative economy. And I'll recite a couple of the topics of some of the sessions. Creative Economy 101, what's the criteria for success? Creative cityscapes, developing diverse and interactive environments. And we both have had the opportunity to interact with Charles Landry, who is focused around the world on looking at cityscapes and creating interactive environments within cities, funding creative ideas in industries, human talent. And I think this is really an extremely important one because we've also done a study, which you're familiar with, called The Young and the Restless. And if you don't have creative human capital, and especially that age group 25 to 34 that you can attract and retain in your city, you're not going to have a vibrant innovation economy, and especially you're not going to be able to attract those people within the creative economy. And we have also some additional panels. And by the way, we've received proposals for presentations from all over the world, people from Sydney, Lyon, France, Sweden, Tokyo, Canada, Poland, England, and numerous from many cities in the United States who would like to come to Philadelphia to present at this conference. So I think we're going to get to get exposed to what's happening globally with the latest trends. Some of the panel discussions that they've presented to us are democratizing film and television distribution. What's the economic impact and best practices in creating a dynamic music destination? And diverse perspectives on designing environments for the creative economy. Additionally, we're going to be talking about webcasting, which is really hot within the creative economy today and in the media world. Cool space indicators, how can you evaluate what constitutes a cool space and how do you get more cool spaces in your cities and regions? And then how creative startup companies can bring their ideas to the marketplace, because a lot of people are very creative. And what we've been working on with the University of the Arts here, which is a fine arts academic institution, is we're trying to integrate more business into what they're doing with their creative students, because they won't be able to maximize the benefit of their ideas unless they can find some way to get them to market.
Does every city, Rich, have the potential to develop the potential of creative industries?
Well, I think that, Carol, every city has their own unique personality and footprint. There are some cities that are blessed with more potential than others. For example, it's going to be hard to compete with an LA or New York when you're looking at the strengths that they have within their certain sectors within the creative economy. But if you look at what we're doing in Philadelphia right now, we've got a very active film industry here. What I would classify us as is a very diverse, broad-based creative economy that doesn't specialize in one specific industry, and we have the ability of trying to converge these things together. So I think smaller market areas or smaller regions around the United States and around the world probably have niches within the creative economy which they can help differentiate themselves. And more importantly, one of the aspects of this conference is connect the haves with the have-nots and even the haves and the haves of how can we get more connectivity around the creative economy? How can we leverage each other's resources more effectively so that we can get a greater return on these assets within our cities and regions?
In your opinion, who's doing the most interesting thinking right now in this area of the economic potential of the creative industries?
I'd have to say Innovation Philadelphia.
Well, okay, beyond Innovation Philadelphia.
Well, I mean,
you've been getting proposals all over the world. You've been thinking right about this subject and what really is worthy to bring to a global summit on the topic. And I'm curious, what have you run into that you think, okay, that's something that hasn't been talked about enough, it deserves more exploration from the point of view of an economic development guy, this is something we could run with?
I'm generally not at a loss for words, Carol. But it's hard, out of the 120 proposals that we've seen so far, which are not completed yet, to single out one that is unique or differentiated from another. And to be honest with you, I don't see anybody, and this might not be the answer you're looking for, I can't see any place in the world that is so far ahead that it doesn't create opportunities for cities and regions like Philadelphia, Memphis, Chicago, or wherever you might be in the United States to be able to carve out your own little space within this creative economy. So I think some of the more important things that I see emerging, though, is with new technologies that are developing, how do they get incorporated into things that people have associated with the creative economy, like visual and performing arts? And that's where I see some very interesting things happening, especially even our own town here. We have a section called the Avenue of the Arts, where the University of the Arts is located in most of our theaters, our Performing Arts Center. And what has not happened in the past is that there hasn't been the connectivity between these different institutions and these different elements within the creative economy. What I see people willing to do today more, and we're going to have some sessions on this at the summit, is to get disparate groups of individuals who don't know that they should be sitting down next to each other because they would benefit one another, and how they can take advantage of each other's resources and leverage assets, which are becoming very precious and few today. So it's a long-winded answer to, I'm still waiting for that one big thing to emerge, which I haven't seen yet.
Cities tend to grab on to economic development fads. What, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it was biotech. And before that, it was convention centers. And before that, any number of other things. I'm curious, what's the real potential, in your opinion, of the creative industries? I mean, looking down the road, what percentage of our economy could we expect to be generated by the creative industries?
I just saw a study that was published in New York, and I don't know if you've seen it. It just came out in December. And I think they attribute 5.7% of the total economy of New York City is in the creative industries. And to be honest with you, their definition of the creative economy is more
limited,
restrictive,
yeah,
than what ours is here that we're utilizing within Philadelphia. So if you look at the size of one of the largest companies in the world, 6% of that economy of New York is extremely important to them. If you look at the Philadelphia region, we have done some studies, as you're aware, and we believe that through some of the Richard Florida work and other refinement, about 32% of our region's workforce is a member of the creative class. This creative economy in Philly generates about $44 billion in revenue annually. We graduate about 23% more art graduate students than the national average. You ask about one of the ingredients that was important for these types of cities and regions is that you need to have the raw materials. And we're blessed to have 83 academic institutions and about 300,000 students within the Philly region. And our challenge is to how do we keep them here, especially the best and brightest that can go anyplace in the world. So I think that from an economic standpoint, it will be difficult for a city or a region to totally support itself only around the creative economy, but it will fit into a diversified economic portfolio, and more importantly, it's a component that is critical to supporting a lot of the other industries that would utilize their services or go to a lot of the events that are occurring within the creative community.
Give me the dates of the summit.
It's going to be June 12th through the 14th. It's going to be at the Park Hyatt Philadelphia Hotel, and it's going to be easy to get information on it. We've got a website just for the summit. It's a long one, which is www.ipphila.com/creativeeconomy/GCECS. The easiest thing.
And we'll put a link on our website as well, smartcityradio.com, so people can get to it easily.
And you can always get to it through ipphila.com as well. And Kelly Lee is really the champion for this, and she can be reached at 215-496-8110. And we'd be glad to talk to anyone who has an interest in participating or attending the summit.
Rich, thanks again for being our guest, and good luck with the summit. I look forward to being there.
We look forward to having you back, Carol. We miss you.
Thanks, Rich. Rich Bendis is president and CEO of Innovation Philadelphia. You're listening to Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith says the intrusion of humans on the wilderness habitat should be the focus of our concern rather than the other way around.
In a telling study conducted in the 50s, medical researchers discovered a small Pennsylvania town that had a significantly lower rate of heart attacks than surrounding towns despite no differences in smoking or exercise. The only noticeable difference was a higher level of social cohesion that deliberately discouraged and downplayed public displays of differences in wealth and income. Over time, though, the social taboos against conspicuous consumption weakened, and even though every other factor stayed the same, the rate of heart attacks in this town eventually rose to the same levels as those in nearby towns. This is similar to the findings of British economic historian Richard Wilkinson, who has studied the correlates of life expectancy in developed countries. One of the most important is income inequality. Not absolute wealth, but the distribution of wealth. Based upon his cross-cultural research, Wilkinson concludes that the reason lifespans in the U.S. are shorter than those in less wealthy developed countries like the Netherlands, Israel, Spain, Sweden, Canada, and Japan is because of less inequality in those nations. When social cohesion is fractured by breaks in community, we suffer. But no wave of charity and selflessness is going to rise up and remedy these kinds of societal threats. Political and economic inertia work against that. But maybe there is a way to put selfishness to work. Perhaps the answer is for cities to make the time spent together a superior experience. Indeed, the quality of the time spent engaging with something is more important than ever. In their influential 1999 book, The Experience Economy, consultants Joseph Pine and Jim Gilmore announced the end of selling products and services and a new era of only selling experiences or memorable events staged to engage someone in a personalized way. Going forward, they say, a product or service will be nothing but a commodity unless it's an experience. Marketers agree. These days, every brand from restaurants to refrigerators is looking to deliver experiences. In a world of experiences, everything competes with everything because everything is now delivering the same benefit. Even when it comes to cities, people are looking for compelling experiences. If it isn't worth the time, they will avoid doing it and will do nothing to improve it. Social cohesion must be an experience worth having. Cities must deliver compelling community experiences. This may seem silly, but I'm not talking about theme parks. An experience is not that. It's about making the time spent with something worth it. And the competition for time these days is serious business. Besides, just look at the cities that work best. They offer vibrant experiences of street life, intellectual life, arts, sports, volunteering, and more. Experiences worth having that build loyalty, commitment, and involvement. Part of the answer for creating communities where cohesion is pursued more than inequality is for cities to deliver more of what will interest people in coming together. And that means experiences. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.